You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 186.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You are listening to The Local Maximum. Today, we're joined by Aaron once again and remote this time. How you doing, Aaron?
Good to be here, even if only virtually.
Well, you know, we're going back to old school, and I'd like to say it's because the studio is being totally remodeled. We're ripping it down.
let's go with that.
Yeah, we're getting new furniture in, and that's what we're doing. Oh, let me switch it to my headphones just so that we don't get an echo for you here. All right, so what are we doing today? August, I wanted a news update for August, one or two news updates for August. And wow, it's been such a slow news month, so there's really not much to talk about. But I think we've got to scrape down at the bottom of the barrel and talk about a few things. It looks like the stories that we have today, they're all technology related as usual. But today we're going to talk about some international issues, which I always enjoy talking about. I always like to find out what's going on in the rest of the world, because it kind of gives us a sense of, you know, is something that we're experienced local, or, you know, what technology that we're using, particularly when it comes to the financial system, changes, Bitcoin in particular, what's happening globally is very important. Because I remember in the early days of Bitcoin, when people would say, you know, oh, I don't see any development going on. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. This is permissionless. The whole point is permissionless innovation anywhere in the world. How do you know there's nothing going on? That's what's so special about stuff like this. It's also true of the internet in general. So we are going to talk about Bitcoin in Cuba. We're going to talk about, you know, OnlyFans in the UK. But let's get started with this. Let's get started with Afghanistan, with a non-crypto related story.
Very, very low key, human interest story. Nothing controversial about this one at all.
No, I feel like there's too many takes on Afghanistan. Not that I have no opinion, but it's like, I don't feel like I have anything to add, but this is a pretty interesting story that I covered. I remembered back in 2004 when I was on Yale Radio, when it was like, okay, there are two Jews left in Afghanistan. And, you know, they hate each other. And I just thought that was the most ridiculous story. And it turns out now the story is there's one Jewish guy left in Afghanistan. I'm not talking about like, you know, coalition forces or people there, part of nation building,
but,
or whatever.
But actual a person who is an Afghan.
A person who is an Afghan, right. So the main headline is, the Taliban's coming back to power. I'd like to get out. They try to pack him up. They say, okay, it's time to go. And he changes his mind. No, no, no. You know what? I'm going to stay in Afghanistan. And so that raises some eyebrows for me. So again, I remember this story from 2004. It was the name of the guy is Zebulon Simintov. And the guy he was with, who was older than him, was Yitzhak Levy. And they were basically feuding over the control of the last synagogue in Afghanistan. And, you know, people laugh at this because they say it's a very Jewish story. But after looking at the news over the last 20 years, I also suspect it's a very Afghan story as well.
I'm curious, but a little afraid to ask if we know what was the schism between the two of them that was causing this feud, or was it just they had to have something to argue about?
Yeah, it was very hard to understand from what I've seen. It's like, I don't understand half the feuds that are going on in Afghanistan. And also, like, you know, they're Afghans, they're being translated, they're talking in Dari, which is the language over there. But from what I understand, there's a dispute over ownership of the synagogue, and like one of them thinks the other one is interfering in his business and turning away customers and stuff like that. So this was followed up in the New York Post this. Oh, and by the way, so just some interesting tidbit on Afghanistan. This guy was born in the 1950s. He's like in his 60s. He lives in Afghanistan. He was born in the Kingdom of Afghanistan. That used to be a thing in a town called Herat. Now he's in Kabul. So, you know, back when there was a Jewish community in Afghanistan, I think that was the town it was in. I think it's a town or a city near near Iran. So anyway, since then, I was like, well, how many governments has he lived under? I've counted. Okay, he was born into the Kingdom of Afghanistan. Then it was turned into overthrown, turned into the Republic of Afghanistan. Then the Socialist Democratic Republic of Afghanistan. Then the Soviet invasion to make sure it stayed a socialist republic or something like that. Then the Soviet retreat and the civil war between the Taliban and the Northern Alliance, followed by the American occupation, followed by the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan, which is the government you know, we've been trying to prop up, and now the Taliban again. So that's
Taliban 2, Electric Boogaloo.
That's that's the sequel. Yes, yeah, so that's quite a few. So
yeah, I've heard the factoid floating around that there are many adults in Afghanistan who for whom this will be their sixth government to live under. And I guess it depends on how exactly
how you
slice that. But
right.
But he definitely meets that that threshold.
Sure. Yeah.
And I can see why he might not want to leave. It seems very similar to you hear about whenever there's a big hurricane, like for Katrina or something on that magnitude, there are always people who say, you know, well, I lived through the last big one. I'm not leaving now. You know, if it's my time, it's my time, but I'm not going to run from it. And
right.
I can imagine there's a little bit of that going on here.
Yeah. But I also saw in some of the interviews he did, he was like, yeah, the Taliban's pretty brutal. They're beating people with chains there. So it's not like he... is like, Taliban's not so bad. You know, he's just like, I don't know. He seems a little bit nuts in a few, but I don't want to call everybody. I mean, it seems like everybody in that whole country is nuts. So I don't want to, you know, go there necessarily. It's a very different culture, you know, and even though you know, he's Jewish, I don't want to pretend to like, know that I understand his thought process here. But anyway, the last paragraph of the New York Post is a doozy. I'm gonna read this paragraph. You ready for it? All right.
Hit me with it.
Simintov became the country's last Jew after the death of Yitzhak Levy. And actually, Yitzhak Levy had a more like Afghan-sounding name. But anyway, in 2005, though they both lived in the same rundown synagogue, their hatred for one another was the stuff of legend. For years, the two men spoke mostly to each other in swears and regularly denounced the other to Taliban authorities. Once during a mutual stint in jail, their arguing was so annoying that their Islamic captors simply released them. Now, I have so many questions. First of all, you know, I hear some very serious stories about the Taliban these days. I don't know what's true, but I heard, you know, they're executing people for downloading Christian Bibles on their phones. They ripped up Zebulun's Torah, like literally took the Torah, ripped it up. So like, why aren't these guys afraid to be executed, or why weren't they executed is kind of my question. Like what's the situation there? I can only speculate, but maybe it's like
there's the Taliban. A certain old man vibe that,
yeah.
You know, at a certain point you don't care and people fear and respect that.
I guess at a certain point they're like, we're not going to, maybe they don't execute everyone. It's just something that happens sometimes is my guess. But it's,
well, I can definitely see some middle management Taliban bureaucrat being saddled with these guys. And his reaction just being, seriously, really, I have to deal with this. I'm trying to enforce, you know, Islamic law over, you know, whether it's a neighborhood or a city or a country, and I have to deal with these two bickering old men.
Just two bickering old.
Make it somebody else's problem.
I feel like there should be a like a sitcom, you know, Zebulun and Yitzhak. But I don't know. I mean, it would be very politically incorrect. I know that. But
I was about to say, well, maybe it'd be too soon. But I believe there currently is a sitcom about a I don't know if it's an Afghan interpreter.
And it also makes light of some very serious crap that's going down there, which I
which on the one hand can be insensitive and politically incorrect, but on the other hand, sometimes that's the best way to deal with these difficult issues. Is the only way you can start the conversation is by making a little bit light of it, and that can open a door to deeper discussion and broader awareness.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I just wanted to bring this up because this is just a crazy story, and it's amazing that it's one person that we're talking about, because it's just like, he's just like, well, I'm just not leaving. I'm just gonna yeah. stay.
Well, and it certainly seems like there's a an expiration date on it, because even if he lives out his natural life there, there is not a Jewish community in Kabul or perhaps in Afghanistan as a whole to live on after him.
Yeah, yeah, or not openly. I mean,
I mean, it won't be the first country to have completely, either actively eliminated or have run out the clock on its Jewish minority.
Yeah, and there used to be, I think I read 40,000, a community of 40,000 Jews there in 1940.
Back during the Kingdom days?
No, I think before, like 1940. I think it was... I am afraid to get this wrong, but I believe it was one of the Nazi-influenced governments during World War II. It doesn't mean the Holocaust was happening there, but it was just not very friendly during those years. And then especially...
Yeah, I certainly don't know much about
in the creation of
what was going on in that part of the world during that particular period.
Yeah, well, different countries in the Middle East had very different situations going on. And don't necessarily match up with what's going on today, which is, you know, because they've all been through so many governments that it's at times hard to keep track. So what's fascinating is, like, if this guy gets arrested, if this guy gets killed, if this guy dies, like, we're going to hear about it, which is like, you know that. So it'll be in the Post, which is, I mean, I'm sure, I'm sure they don't read the Post over there, that's very interesting.
I guess something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're following this story now. That's it. I've decided. Okay, so I think we're ready to move on. Now I want to talk about...
From one potentially oppressive regime to another.
To another. Yeah, exactly. We're going to go to Cuba. And this is a really, I thought, very well-researched article in Bitcoin Magazine by Alex Gladstein. It's because it's very comprehensive. It tells us about what's really going on in Cuba with Bitcoin. And he also goes into, like, a lot of the history of Cuba and its monetary system. So if you're interested in all of that, go to localmaxradio.com/186 and get the link, because this is...
I assume that Bitcoin Magazine is a digital-only publication.
Well, I don't know if they have a physical version, but I think they probably...
Certainly digital first.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So first of all, what's going on in Cuba? I don't want to give the whole background, but there's some background that we do need. Cuba is having its worst downturn since 1994. And apparently that one in 1994 was sort of an aftershock of the fall of communism and the fact that the Soviet Union wasn't around to give aid. And there was actually...
A 30... Timeline-wise, fall of communism, we date that to, what, 91?
I guess so,
89?
Yeah, I always... Because the fall of the Berlin Wall was 89, but I think the actual fall of the
took a couple years for the rest of the...
91. Yeah, so... the fall of the Berlin Wall was not... Like, the USSR still existed. It was just... Yeah, okay, so... 1994, there was a 35% decline in the economy, which is... that's a crazy number. If you know how some of these, some of the gyrations that can occur in an economy like this, in a communist economy or a socialist economy. So the protests were pretty large back then, but last month's protests He says, we're actually bigger. Turns out that the protests that happened in Cuba last month were, in at least the measurement they're using, the biggest since the Cuban Revolution. So the biggest ever against the Cuban government as currently formed. And Bitcoin Magazine cites internet and communications as the reason for this. You know, like we've covered in a previous episode, I'll find out later. But it's, you know, we learned, and I learned when I visited Cuba, that the internet is very tightly controlled there, but they can't control it completely. They have to, they can cut it, but they have to allow some of it to go on because it's necessary for international commerce. That's the only way they can keep things going. You know, like, you know, I got my Airbnb through the internet, obviously. I didn't call them up. So,
How comparable is their setup to for example, the Great Firewall of China? That obviously China is very much tied into the modern internet.
Yeah, China's high tech economy.
They kind of have their own ecosystem.
No, Cuba, it's very, very difficult to use the internet. You have to basically, like, you have minutes and you have to, like, you have to pay for minutes. They tell you who's allowed on, who's not allowed on. You have to kind of go into the park and use it. Highly tracked. I would say much more, closed than China. China has a high tech sector, in a way that Cuba just has none. So
certainly, yeah,
it's China needs the internet a lot more. Okay. So they talked to they talked to a bunch of sources. There are a bunch of interviews. The first one on there is this woman, Lucia, who's a 30-year-old medical worker in Matanzas, a city of 150,000. I'm not exactly sure where that is. Actually, let's look that up. Matanzas, Cuba. Right. All right. I see. Okay. So it's in the north. It's not very far from Havana. Looks like about an hour, 2 hour drive from Havana to the west. Okay, so basically, what she reports to this journalist is she says the food, electrical, toilet, very hard to get supplies. Their toilet paper shortage is, I'm guessing, probably a lot worse than our toilet paper shortage back in March 2020 when I had toilet paper. It was just like everyone who wanted toilet paper could get it, but they're like, but it's the itchy kind, you know.
I'm very curious how self-sufficient Cuba is, given how, and maybe this is my skewed perception as an American. Maybe the embargo really doesn't mean much of anything other than getting U.S. goods.
Yeah, but they can trade how with other places.
Of what they need, do they make domestically versus, you know, are they much like us, dependent on a lot of stuff shipping from China or
yeah,
you know, other nations?
So they're very dependent on international trade, and I'm going to get into this in a bit because that's what's causing a lot of the problems. They can't seem to produce things locally like they need, and so they are reliant on trade. In terms of the embargo for specific goods, they could trade with every other country besides the U.S., so they're not barred from getting specific goods. But that stuff does hurt in terms of, you know, trade between Cubans and their relatives in the U.S., which is
big
quite
deal
a bit
for remittances and that type of thing.
Right, right. Okay, so and they also report that supposedly the healthcare system is collapsing. And I don't know what to say. I could almost say something sarcastic about, well, I was told they had the most wonderful healthcare system in the world, but I don't know. I was there. A lot of things were falling apart. I mean, I can't prove that they don't have a great healthcare system, but it's going to take a lot more to convince me than a Michael Moore movie. And I'll look at this data from the UN, which actually came from the Cuban government.
And I'm very curious what the actual metrics are there, because I've been hearing news reports about how the American healthcare system is on the verge of collapsing because of COVID-related things for the last, you know, 12 to 18 months.
And it turns out to be not really as true.
I don't know if they're talking the same type of thing there, or if this is a much, much deeper issue that they're encountering that certainly I wouldn't imagine COVID has made it better.
Right. No. But they say like the hospitals are filled up and there's bodies on the street, but they also had reports like that about, you know, New York. And then it turned out to be not true really. I mean, like, you know, it's other than...
Yeah. Well, and presumably...
Or at least given the wrong impression.
Unbiased reporting access to Cuba is somewhat more fraught than to New York City.
Yeah. Okay, so Cuba, things are bad, right? So what's happening with the money in Cuba? That's a more, you know, that's a more, I guess, specific thing that's going on. Right now, the government has a little program going on called monetary purification. And if you think that sounds scary, wait until you see what's going on. So basically, they had this crisis in 1994. And so since 1994, the government said, okay, our money, we're having some issues with our money, so we're actually going to have two monetary systems. And when I was there in 2018, which was actually right when I started the podcast, right, between episode zero and episode one, I had to use their dual monetary system. So they had two currencies. They had the CUP and the peso. The peso is their day-to-day currency that the people of Cuba, specifically for the people of Cuba, which by law is pegged to the dollar 24 to 1. I don't know why they're pegging everything to their enemy's currency, which is us, but that's what they're doing. And then the CUP...
Well, because if they pegged it to the Venezuelan... Yeah. Bolivar, then they'd be in big trouble.
And so the CUP, that's the money that's just for tourists. And that is, I get them confused. The CUP is the peso. The P stands for peso. And the CUC is the money that I got, which is pegged to the dollar 1 to 1. And I feel like that's the one that is actually backed by the dollar. To some degree, and the tourists get those. So you could go in and like spend those in stores. And so you're, as a tourist, not really affected by all the shortages. So you could get whatever you want. Whereas the people in Cuba, not whatever you want. There are still things that like, you know, that they don't have in the country, but you're kind of walking around buying stuff that the average Cuban can't buy. And you're kind of thinking, well, that's kind of messed up.
This raises a bunch of questions.
Yeah.
So first of all, like, are you shopping in stores that are purely for tourists, or would natives be able to shop there as well? And if so, are prices listed in, you know, two different currencies?
No.
Or do they just do the conversion in their head?
Yeah. So those stores are only CUCs.
Tourists only?
Yeah. Tourists only, or a local if you happen to get your hands in a CUC, like if I went into a non-tourist only store and spent it, which is, of course, what they're trying
to do. And that 24 to 1, that's a fixed ratio?
Yeah, but
that
it's not.
Float at
but
all?
It's not really worth 20. It's worth a lot less. It's inflationary, much more. Well, I guess they're both inflationary, technically, but the ones for the people.
But because
is way
they can't easily convert between them, then it's less.
It's
relevant.
It's like in the last episode when we talked about when we had a gold and silver.
I was going to bring up this begs the question of Gresham's Law, which I think you talked about in the Goldback episode.
Right. So back then we had gold and silver and it was pegged, which meant that one was more valuable and you didn't want to spend it. But the difference is those were two good currencies, whereas in this case you have one really bad currency and one that's just merely US dollar bad. And one that's like third world peso bad. So let me read some of this. Lucia described the system's output as creating a reality where she could buy a cup of coffee, a bus ride, or even a small meal for an incredibly cheap price in pesos, but a pair of shoes or a phone plan priced in CUCs could cost an entire month's salary. So that's sort of how it is to be a Cuban citizen. You can't get... And this system is gone, by the way. They recently removed it. That's this monetary purification. I'm just explaining what was there. So,
gotcha.
But so yeah.
Wait, so this dual currency system is the monetary purification, or this is the precursor to that?
Precursor.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we'll get to the purification in a minute.
So you have the dual system. What economic forces are at play here? Sounds like Gresham's Law is going on a lot, where in this case the dollar is the good currency, even though our politicians spend $1 trillion like it's nothing. It's still better, apparently, than what they have going on down there. Yeah.
Is there also like a black or gray market for actual dollars? Or because the...
I can't answer that. I don't know.
The CUC is pegged to the dollar 1-to-1, then it's not really different.
I assume there is, but I don't know.
Okay. But you never paid for anything with actual physical American dollars.
No, I don't think it was legal, but I don't quite remember. So let me just read another clip. So in tragic irony, unskilled workers were often far better off financially than highly educated ones. I'm going to read that again. The unskilled workers in Cuba, some of them were far better off financially than highly educated ones. Why would that be? So many people dropped their careers, it says, to clean tables or pick people up from the airport, from the international airport, to get access to the CUC economy. The dual currency system institutionalized inequality, creating clear classes of haves and have-nots. And for many people like Lucia, this is as much as anything else showed that the revolution was a sham. Because think about it. Like, is this what was promised under communism? This is like the exact opposite. This is...
Yeah, well, and I guess that makes sense because in a country where you have nationalized healthcare, who pays the doctors and nurses' salaries? The government. And obviously they're going to be paying that in those the CUPs, the 24-to-1 currency. Or if you work at the university, well, I would imagine that all universities in Cuba are state universities,
right?
And so your salary comes from the government.
And
I don't
and
know how far
salary.
How far down that goes, but yeah, unless you're directly interfacing with tourism, then you're not maybe entirely cut out from the CUC market, but you're probably a degree or two removed from it, and so
that makes a difference.
You only get very light trickle down.
Again, it's like you want to be picking people up from the airport and getting those tips. All right. So what's happening now? So they took a look at this, the policymakers in Cuba, and apparently decided this isn't working very, very well. As of January 1st, 2021, the CUC was officially phased out. This is the monetary purification. So they're Cubans were given 6 months to exchange your CUCs, those the dollars, for pesos at the official exchange rate. So you're basically losing a lot of money there. It says Cubans have lost nearly two-thirds of their purchasing power since the end of 2020, as the price of a dollar has gone from the official rate of 24 pesos to costing as much as 70 pesos on the black market. Okay, so they're like, all right, you know what? This dual currency system is not good. We're just going to use one currency. But then they have a problem because they can't do international trade. So they replaced those CUCs with something called MLC credits, which sounds like it's very similar, which you get when you're doing international commerce. So they basically can't get out of this system because they need hard money for trade, but the MLCs are digital only. So they've replaced their CUCs with a digital version, it sounds like. And that's their kind of bait and switch, but almost like their pretend reform where they end up back at the same in the same place. So, and basically all the Cubans who were making their CUCs thinking they were in the money, they were like, yep, no, we're taking that. So that's what's going on now. Now, how do they find out about Bitcoin? It's very tough to use the internet in Cuba. How would they find out? So this is really fascinating. So apparently, what news do you think they would get in Cuba on their TV? What kind of news?
Well, probably not Fox News or MSNBC.
No. So they're getting propaganda, which, I mean, is the same. Okay. I'm not saying that the Fox News and MSNBC are not propaganda.
It's a different flavor of propaganda.
Yes, yes. They have to get their own state propaganda. And so one of the ones that they allow on, which we can watch too, is RT Russia Today, because it's reliable Russian propaganda. But it happens to have an American show on it because it has a show called The Kaiser Report by American Max Kaiser. And they love playing it because he's like very critical of U.S. foreign policy. But apparently Well, I mean, I've seen him on YouTube. Most of the time, he's just evangelizing Bitcoin. So it's kind of like a Trojan horse there. So he's evangelizing Bitcoin on his show on Russia Today, and people are finding out about it and they're joining like these groups on Telegram, which is apparently a chat app that they can't stop. And people are impressed. They're like, wow, no bank, no ID, no permission to trade. This is groundbreaking. And so how is the state reacting? The state is apparently reacting very slow. They're not like shut it down. They're still at the point where they don't know what's going on. Currently, the Cuban government is telling people, well, Bitcoin is one of these multi-level marketing scams that you don't want to be involved in. But that's really it. It takes some educating. I love this. At one point, I'll get to it. One person reported that they interviewed this guy, a TV personality, Erich Cruz. He says Bitcoin is exploding, and he said the government will incorporate Bitcoin policy in their next 5-year plan. So I don't know where the next one ends, but if they kind of miss it this time, they got to wait another 5 years. That is in Bitcoin timeline. That's a pretty long time. So he said the alternative to getting hard money is the mule method, where you wire money to someone and then they physically go to Cuba and give you cash, whereas Bitcoin is instantaneous. And he says 100,000 Cubans are using Bitcoin on a regular basis, more per capita than in the U.S. and in Canada and places like this. And they're using Lightning-enabled wallets like Mon and Blue Wallet, just like El Salvador, so you can transact quickly with very low fees.
I was going to ask, are they mostly using this to get money in and out of the country, or is it actually for exchanges, regular transactions in Cuba?
They say both.
Between Cubans.
I mean, I'm pretty sure it's not like Bitcoin Beach
Is that El Salvador?
In El Salvador, right. But, if you're getting this stuff from abroad, why wouldn't you trade it locally as well? And if you're meeting up with people locally who are doing it, why wouldn't you do it as well? So apparently this is, in fact, happening. And people, you can get these wallets. It's amazing that the government hasn't tried to shut it down, but they have so many other problems that it seems like they can't, and this thing is growing. So the plot thickens in Cuba, which is really fascinating.
Yeah, I'll just make the comment that when I was looking at our notes here right before you got to the part about the government claiming it's a multi-level marketing scam.
Yeah.
And I was a little confused because I saw there's MLM, there's MLC, there's CUC, oh, yeah. And
CUP, CUP.
CUP is so many acronyms here.
Yeah, I mean, governments like acronyms. MLM is more multi-level marketing. We have it here.
Right.
What they reported was like, because times are tough in Cuba, same thing when times are tough in the U.S., a lot of people turn to multi-level marketing kind of things to make some extra money, which is usually like kind of a pyramid scheme type thing. And so the government is telling people that Bitcoin's a pyramid scheme. I was told when Bitcoin first came out here that it's a pyramid scheme, actually. There are still people who say it, but you have to be educated.
Well, yeah, if you don't believe that it has any inherent value, then it does kind of seem like a pyramid scheme in that you're... The only way that you can increase the value of your holdings is to get other suckers to buy into it and pump up the price. But that's assuming that there's, like I said, no inherent value to the Bitcoin and the blockchain, which I think there's some dispute about for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So that's all I wanted to say about Cuba. But, I mean, this changes kind of my impression of what's going on there quite a bit. And I don't know what's going on with their government. Like, is it stable? Did they crack down on the protests? What's going on with that? But it certainly is interesting that that this kind of stuff is taking off, and I don't think they're going to stop it. And so it's just another, it's just they've moved up a level in terms of their use in Bitcoin, and this is going to continue. So that's all.
Cuba has certainly dropped out of the news cycle given everything that's been happening in Afghanistan, and I think even before that they were falling down the priority list there. But even when they were a trending topic, so to speak, this was not the angle that you were hearing much about. So this is fascinating to dig into a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, before Afghanistan, we were talking about Andrew Cuomo, and I feel like I heard the other day, like, and like Governor Cuomo announces X, Y, and Z. I was like, isn't he gone? And they're like, oh no, he announced a 2-week thing. And then it's like, well, how has that been less than 2 weeks? It seems almost impossible. But anyway, that's just a comment on the news cycle these days. All right, last
life,
one.
Life can move pretty fast.
Yeah, last one. I want to be pretty quick with this. OnlyFans, which is a site where you can pay to see content from someone. I guess locals where we're at, you could pay content, but this is a different kind of content. It's usually pornographic content. This is a UK-based company. So apparently they've got a lot of porn on it, and they say, we're changing our policy. No porn per se, only nudes. So this is and more interesting, I'm not reporting this as kind of like, just for fun. This is the reason why they're doing this is because they're talking about the financial system, specifically in the UK, where they said it's because of the payment processors. They say they're getting a lot of pressure from banking partners and payment providers, and that they're trying to raise money from the outside investors. They're valuated at over $1 billion, which is quite a bit. And they are having trouble raising money because of this problem where they feel like they could be shut out of the banking system at any moment. So in terms of this article, where is this article that I'm looking? Oh, Bloomberg. I use the Bloomberg article. There was an article from CNN or whatever, but I feel like Bloomberg is usually pretty good with stuff like this. They also wrote as a product strategy that they're going to try to position itself more as a forum for musicians, fitness instructors, and chefs. But I have a hard time believing that they're going to be able to shift that far.
So certainly you can make the argument that they were not exclusively a site providing sexual content. Right. But that was by far the majority of their content, from my understanding. Much like you can find things on Pornhub that are not porn, you can find all sorts of educational and instructional content on there. But it is by volume a tiny portion of what's on there. You can make a similar argument about the Pirate Bay. Some of it is the distribution of legitimate, torrents like Linux distributions and stuff, and large data set files. But most of it is stuff being sold in violation of DRM and copyright.
Yeah. So it sounds like OnlyFans is trying to go legit, so to speak, they're board or whatever, their leadership decided, okay, we're going to play with the banking system and go in this direction.
It sounds like this may be a necessary prerequisite for them to going public. They want to take that valuation and sure, cash in on it.
Sure. But, this is where the new economy comes in, and this is where you can compare what's happening to, people like sex workers on OnlyFans to people in Cuba, where basically they're going to turn to the crypto economy, and we have to face the fact that with the emergence of the crypto economy, this will be a non-issue, and it's almost guaranteed that companies will fill the void and be like, well, we don't have to worry about the banking system anymore. We'll just accept crypto. So having the rise of the crypto economy, like it or not, it will mean the proliferation of sex work online. But it also means increased financial freedom because these so-called banking partners are acting as gatekeepers for unimproved groups. And I want to go back to episode 28 when we talked about Alex Jones being removed from all social media at once. He was removed from Twitter and Facebook and YouTube all at the same time. And people are like, well,
yeah, like within 48 hours,
right,
or something.
And people, yeah, people are like, well, he's so nuts. Why should I care? But, we know what happens. They didn't stop at Alex Jones, and they just went they just got nuttier and nuttier. In 2018, it seemed like, well, you know, maybe it's not
that
bad.
And as a corollary to that, they didn't silence Alex Jones.
No,
Alex Jones still has, has a platform.
Right.
They just shoved him into a quote-unquote darker corner of the internet.
Yeah, he still goes on Joe Rogan's show.
And that's absolutely what's going to happen with at least a portion of these folks who are engaging in sex work is they will be forced to find another way to go about this, and it very well may be a less safe way for them to do that.
Well, that's one of the things that OnlyFans, like people said about OnlyFans, like it's a safe alternative to.
I hate to use this meme structure, but in a way they were the Uber of sex work that they allowed, you know, kind of an independent contractor approach that was much more flexible and better served the people actually doing the work.
Yeah.
I don't want to get too deep into this angle of it, but there's a bit of a religious or cultural crusade aspect to this that people are claiming, oh, we're doing this to prevent sex trafficking and child abuse and that type of thing, which is if at all a tiny 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 minority of the impact that's going to happen here, and I think the most people making that claim, you know, it's Like in most classic Think of the Children arguments, it's a fig leaf for doing something that they want to do just so that they can convince other people to say, oh, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
Right. I think the main point that I wanted to make here is that, you know, the social media bans did not stop with Alex Jones. Then they went on to journalists, dissidents, presidents. Taliban's okay. But, you know, a whole bunch of people got shadow banned. Like the New York Post, whatever. And that only happened in like a few years. And so these financial gatekeepers are not going to stop at OnlyFans. I think we're going to start seeing massive financial censorship as well as social media censorship. And, you know, the crypto economy is stepping up just in time for that. So this will speed it up. Porn is always an early adopter.
They tend to be on the bleeding edge of technology. See VHS and virtual reality, and I'm sure, and the internet in general.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah.
They're willing to take risks on that front.
Sure. Yeah. So all this is sign of the times. Everything we talked about is chess pieces moving into place. I feel like some big changes are coming, I'm excited to keep up with the unfolding crypto economy story here on the Local Maximum.
Yeah, I think all of these issues, I'm going to be very curious to see how they get how they solve or route around these restrictions. I suspect that crypto and blockchain and distributed data is going to be a big part of that, with the exception of Zebulon Simontov. I don't think crypto is going to dramatically change his outlook, but you never know.
Poor Zebulon, he has no one to trade with. Although, I don't know, maybe, you know what?
Well, we haven't heard anything about what the Taliban's view on crypto is. I wouldn't be surprised if they crack down on it, but
I wouldn't be surprised if they're using it also.
Well,
I mean,
the two are not mutually exclusive.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, they're probably facing international sanctions, so I would expect that they'd have to be pretty sophisticated, although their media presence seemed to be pretty sophisticated, so maybe they are using it. I'm going to make a prediction about Afghanistan. I don't think the Taliban are going to run the country as the Taliban as we know it for that long, just because of the past in that country has been very unstable. So Although, you know, you never know. They could be, this could be like a new Cuban revolution where they have a totalitarian government come to power and it can stay for a while, but I suspect not. I
think you're right that it's going to be a different style of leadership management, governing than, you know, than they were 20 years ago, pre 2001. But I'm struggling to see how you could explicitly operationalize that prediction. You know, what are the metrics right there?
Well, another thing to keep in mind, I mean, look, this could end in the next few months, who knows, but the Afghan civil war is not over. Like, there are still fighting groups being like, you know, we will fight the Taliban to the end of the earth. So I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, yeah, but much in the same way that really at no point in the 20 years that that American forces, the coalition forces were there, was the war over. There was still always low-key conflict going on.
Yeah.
I expect that that's going to persist for at least a significant period, if not indefinitely.
Yeah, so again, Afghanistan, too complicated. I don't want to give... I mean, I could give my bad take and... it could be thrown in the pile of everybody else's bad take and maybe not look any worse, but, you know, that's all I could ask. But all right. So, very interesting update from around the world. Very, very cool episode. Thanks for joining me today, Aaron. Any last thoughts? And, I think we already gave our last thoughts.
It's been fun as always. Yeah. And, you know, it's making me want to take a trip to Cuba,
Yeah, no, it was worth it. It was worth it. We should plan a trip together when we can.
Maybe a future Local Maximum Tech retreat to be held in Havana.
Imagine if we record. We could bring this Zoom. Can we bring the Zoom device in the country and record an episode from Cuba? I mean, like, they weren't checking my bags on the way in, so.
I would imagine that recording equipment would not be that controversial, but then again, maybe it gets you flagged as a journalist and you get extra scrutiny. I don't know. This is way outside my realm of expertise.
Yeah. Well, all right. But maybe we'll try. I mean, the worst thing that happens
future goals
confiscated. All right. Great. Thanks again, Aaron, for coming on. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week. Feel the power.